When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
Welcome back to the Crossover NBA Podcast. Chris Mannix and Howard Beck. And Beck, how happy are you that the first round is in the book? Seemed like that took forever. 2.5 weeks to get through the first round. What are we doing here?
It always takes too long. I guess it's an improvement over back in the day. I loved the best of five first round. But it's not as if they got that over with any quicker. They just spaced it out even further. So, yeah, glad the first round's done. Glad we're on to the second round. We've got some teams to bury, some teams to praise, and, championship race starting to come into focus.
You really like the best of five? I didn't dig the best of five.
Loved
it. I thought that was kind of unfair to the top-seeded team, just because, you want to give, best of seven, the best team usually wins. Best of five, not always the case.
Yeah, but... I mean, what do we love about March Madness? People like go crazy for March Madness. Why? Because there's drama, because it's win or go home. And when it comes to the NBA, suddenly it's, we've got to give everybody every chance in the world to win a series and eliminate almost any possibility of upsets. If there's no possibility of an upset, then why are we even playing it? Especially the 1-8s and the 2-7s are so predictable. And yes, of course, you play 82 games to earn the top seeding, and you don't want to see it vanish with a couple of bad games. On the other hand, if it's a foregone conclusion, then what are we doing? Why are we risking guys getting hurt and everything else for a series, especially, again, the 1-8s and the 2-7s, where there's almost no chance of an upset? So I like the idea of, or just the possibility of, an upset. I like the drama of it, and I'll never forget Lakers-Kings 1-8 matchup in 2000, Phil Jackson's first season. The Lakers win the first two at home. They just fall on their faces in the two games in Sacramento, and they come home with facing elimination after a 67-win season. And, of course, they blew the Kings out, I think, in game five, and so it was fine. But for a moment there was drama. And, I thought that's kind of why we watch sports, is for the drama.
I guess you're right. Five games can be fun. I don't see it. Well, first of all, anything – this goes for the regular season, too. When people say, play less games – anything that involves less games is not going to happen. It is never, ever going to happen, because that means people make less money.
I have no illusions.
That is not what we do in the NBA.
I have no illusions of us ever going back to best of five, but I can dream. The shortening the season, though, there's a different calculation, because the league, one, they can offset some of the lost revenue with whatever, their midseason tournament, which I hate, or with gambling revenue.
The midseason tournament is like that red herring that gets dangled. The midseason tournament is not happening.
It's Adam Silver's white whale. Every 18 months, like clockwork, there's a report. It's gaining momentum again. This time for sure, then poof. Nobody wants to do it.
Gone. Yeah, always. All right. That's, I don't know how we went down that rabbit hole, but
my fault.
Let's talk about the Celtics and the Bucks series. Bucks take game one on Sunday, and they came out, Howard, and punched the Celtics in the mouth. Boston was coming off that four-game sweep of Brooklyn. Robert Williams was back. They were feeling good about themselves. A lot of people were now picking the Celtics, not just to beat Milwaukee, but to win the championship. And the Celtics, they got punked There's no other way to look at it. They got punked. The Bucks came out, were the more physical team in the first quarter. They overcame the offensive loss of Chris Middleton by playing elite-level defense. Giannis Antetokounmpo didn't really play a great overall offensive game. He passed the ball well, but he was 9 for 25 from the floor, 0 for 2 from 3, and the Bucks, they still win big. What did you think of a surprising game one between Milwaukee and Boston?
Yeah, I mean, listen, obviously really impressive showing by the defending champs, and maybe we shouldn't be that surprised. I guess my first reaction was so much for people like me saying, whoa, the Bucks, they might have it come back to haunt them that they decided they didn't want home court advantage and gave away that that possibility on the last day of the regular season when they benched their entire rotation, basically, and played their G League team. Didn't matter. They just stole home court advantage back in game one. So my other quick reaction, of course, was, okay, Celtics, like, you know, you felt pretty good about the way you manhandled the Nets, and that's fine, that's fair, and somewhat earned, but this points up just how flawed the Nets were and how much more solid the Bucks are, because the Nets defensively are nowhere near the stratosphere of the Bucks, and we saw how much harder it was for Tatum and Jaylen Brown and the rest of them to get to the shots they wanted yesterday. And then, you know, obviously there's the flip side of it too. The Nets were terrible defensively. The Bucks were great, but also the flip side of it, the Bucks offense actually has ball movement involved. Giannis will dominate the ball to an extent, but Giannis will dominate it so that he can also pick you apart, and had what, like double digit assists yesterday, 12 assists yesterday. The Nets don't do that either. So the Nets, stagnant offense, non-existent D. So yes, the Celtics have to actually exert a little bit more if they're going to win this series.
I was really impressed with Milwaukee. You look at that first round against Chicago, and the first couple of games, you start to look at the Bucks and be like, all right, well, maybe, you know, this, you know, normal-ish regular season was a foreshadowing of, you know, not the same kind of postseason we saw last year. The Bulls won one game, the Bucks look kind of sluggish in another, but since that game too, Milwaukee has looked great. Like, they have been excellent, and they've done it by doubling down on what they do defensively. That's what Giannis said after the game on Sunday, especially in the absence of Chris Middleton. They know they have to be a great defensive team to win games. And you mentioned how Brooklyn is not Milwaukee. I don't think Boston thought that coming into that game, but they realized how diametrically different those two teams are. I mean, Kevin Durant was probably Brooklyn's best defender, and he's their best offensive player as well, and he's playing 46-plus minutes every single night. This Bucks team is good at multiple positions. You've got Jrue Holiday, who is one of the best perimeter defenders in the league. He's on Jason Tatum. He's on Jaylen Brown. He held the both of them to terrible shooting nights. You've got Giannis, who in addition to his ridiculous offensive talents, is in the running every single year for Defensive Player of the Year. And the icing on the cake is that you can't undersell the importance of Brook Lopez being back in that lineup. Brook Lopez returned from that back injury in mid-March, and he is just a linchpin to that defense. He is great at rebounding. He had 10 boards in that game one. He's even better at boxing out. I know you've heard this before, Howard, from people in Brooklyn and everywhere Brook Lopez has played, but he's one of the best box-out guys in the entire league. He has no problem finding the biggest body out there on the floor, getting his body on them, and clearing the space needed for Giannis or Bobby Portis or whoever to grab that rebound. He is a huge, huge part of what this team does defensively. And the Bucks, they made Boston play their game. The Celtics are a three-point shooting team. They always have been. They took 53s in game one. 53s in game one. They had 10, they made 10 shots inside the three-point line. They had 20 overall points in the paint. They played how the Bucks wanted them to play. Now, the Celtics would argue that some of those shots were good looks. They played drive and kick. They just didn't fall to go down. And there's some truth to that. But you shoot 53s, you are doing exactly what Milwaukee wants you to do. So this was a top-to-bottom win for the Bucks. I thought Mike Budenholzer had a great game plan. Giannis passed the ball extremely well. That's like everybody's nightmare, Howard, across the league. Like, Giannis operating as a point forward. He had 12 assists in that game, and he was just probing that Celtics defense, looking for other players, waiting for it to kind of develop before he made his move. If the Bucks play like this all series, Celtics might be in some trouble. I think that's for sure.
Yeah, and the fact that Giannis could, in some ways, dominate the game despite going 9 for 25. Like, he took 25 shots to get 24 points. An extremely and uncharacteristically inefficient game for Giannis from that regard. And he had 5 turnovers. So, yeah, like, not a great game for him. And so, you know, by the way, some credit to the Celtics defense for not letting the Bucks just go off. But Giannis can have a tough shooting night and still beat you. He has 13 rebounds, 12 assists. He had a couple of blocks. He can still control the game, dominate the game. And, and obviously Drew Holiday hurt them too, 25 points. I think the Celtics, I do think it matters. I do think it matters that when you're going from series to series and you're adjusting to styles of play and personnel, like, I don't think they actually were, deluded into thinking that everything would be as easy as it was against the Nets, to the extent that that was easy in a sweep. I do think that's a shock to the system when you suddenly face a team that's one of the best defensively in the league. And to your point, yeah, the Bucks are a different team now than they were in those early months of the season. Their record does not reflect just how great this team still is, because they had Brook Lopez out most of the season. But with Brook Lopez and Bobby Portis and Giannis all available, like, the size that they put out there, the resistance they put in the paint and around the rim, like, it matters a lot. And you said it, the Celtics had to take 50 threes. Those are the shots that Bucks wanted them to take. So that's, we always do the whole, how our team's going to adjust between games, all this stuff. Like, that's the adjustment. Like, they obviously need to find a way to some more high percentage shots. And that's not to say take long twos instead of threes. We're not going to go down that road. Just saying, it's a little bit out of whack for the Celtics, and maybe it wasn't the guys that they wanted taking the most threes.
No, the answer is definitely not long twos. We can confirm that taking long twos is not going to get you a win.
But they do need to get into the teeth of the defense.
Yeah. I mean, force the issue, get to the free throw line. Don't, just take what Milwaukee's willing to give you. They're willing to give you those shots for a reason, because they know they're successful with that style of play. The big adjustment is, don't turn the ball over. I think that's where you start. They had 18 turnovers in game one. The Bucks scored 27 points off those turnovers. That's more than a quarter of Milwaukee's offense came off turnovers. So if you're the Celtics, take care of the basketball. But to me, Howard, big game for Jason Tatum. Great series against Brooklyn. Looked like he was more than a match for Kevin Durant in that series, was part of the defensive effort against Durant. But the Bucks and Giannis are just a completely different animal, and you can't go down 0-2 against this Milwaukee team. Tatum was off with his jump shot. I thought he rushed a lot of shots in game one, and I thought he got frustrated with the officials too often. That's been kind of a recurring theme for Jason Tatum over the last couple of years. It was more a issue in the first 2 months of the season when the Celtics were struggling. But watching Tatum play in game one, it just seemed like every time he got bumped, he was looking at the officials, asking for a call, getting back on defense slowly, letting that get into his head a little bit. The Bucks are going to bang him around. Like, they've got guys that can do it, whether it's Holiday on the smaller end, Portis, Giannis on the bigger end. You have got to play through contact. If you don't get the call, put your head back down, get back on defense, and make it up the next time down. This might be, I don't get too hyperbolic, but this is a massive game for Jason Tatum in game two. He has to step up and at least play Giannis to a standstill.
Yeah, I don't think that's a stretch. Look, he earned a lot of praise this season, Jason Tatum. He made that leap from, all-star and all-NBA consideration to absolute all-NBA player. We don't have those results yet. I'm sure the results will bear it out that he's going to be all NBA. I think I had him on my second team. He was in the MVP conversation. Probably not top three on most ballots, but a lot of fourths and fifths. And I assume he's going to finish in the top five there. But you can't, you know, assume that status and then not deliver in the postseason, right? Like, there's hell to pay if you don't. And like, I don't think either of us expecting that he won't. But it's fair to say, like, that's where the attention turns now. You lose home court advantage. You've got a team that's very talented, plays really well together, but you're the clear leader. Jason Tatum is by far the best player on that team. They will only go as far as he can lead them. And, you know, we can all praise everybody for their regular season work, but if you don't back it up in the playoffs, you know, that's where it becomes a little problematic. So I expect we'll see better from him in game two. And yeah, like, it's, you know, you hate starting to start up the cliche machine this soon, but I'd say that's a must win game two for the Celtics.
Hey, I don't want to see any more of those stats about teams that go down 0-2. I've seen them all. They're bad. Don't go They're down bad. 0-2. Yeah. You're probably not going to win the series. Especially monster game coming up.
Especially if you're going down 0-2 at home.
Correct. Yeah. Not going to go well for you when you go back to Milwaukee. All right. The Utah Jazz are done. So let's talk about them for a minute. This has been a tough year for the Jazz. A year where, you know, they just didn't look right all season long. Get into the playoffs. You think they've got a golden opportunity to advance the second round because Luka Doncic is injured in those first couple of games in Dallas, and they don't get both there. You watch them play, and the chemistry doesn't look great. The talent mix, it just doesn't look right. And more importantly, if you can't beat a Dallas team that was without Luka early, what makes you think if you bring this mix back next season it's going to be any better? This team has been together for a while now. You've got Conley, Gobert, Mitchell, Bogdanovich. I mean, these guys have been teammates for 2, 3, 4 years. So, you know, it's not a question of give them another year together and things will get better. There might be a need for a substantial change here in Utah. When you look at the Jazz offseason, like, what's the most pressing concern for you? What's the biggest priority for Danny Ainge this offseason?
I think it just starts with the global question, right? You sit back and you say, okay, has this thing run its course? That's the first thing. It's not, what do we do with Donovan Mitchell versus Rudy Gobert? It's not even necessarily, what do we do with Quinn Snyder if Quinn asks out, as has been rumored that Quinn might want to explore other possibilities. Those are your three key figures, and they are all very much in play, I believe. But this whole offseason evaluation for them, I think, starts with the basic question. Do we actually have the outline and the foundation of an eventual contender here, or is this it? Have we already plateaued? And I think, to your point, Chris, you say 5 years. 5 years is a lifetime in the NBA, or in the life cycle of an NBA roster, because we are in an era of unmitigated free agency and superstar empowerment and contracts that run no more than 5 years, and for a lot of players, 4 years and less. And so you don't have a long window. Even if you think you do, even though Donovan Mitchell's only 25 and Gobert is what, 29? 30?
Late 20s, yeah.
Like, you could say that there's a window there that extends, but no one's that patient. Owners aren't that patient. Front offices, therefore, cannot afford to be that patient. And the stars themselves are not that patient. And we've already been hearing rumblings of Donovan Mitchell's impatience, or his wandering eye, or the possibility that he wants to go home to New York and play for the Knicks and all these things. So you cannot afford to just say, let's let it ride another year and maybe the breaks will come our way, especially when you've seen
pin you down on this here. Do you believe that Rudy Gobert and Donovan Mitchell are the foundation of a championship level team?
I don't. Here's why. So each of them on their own, right? Like, this has been the formula for success for them, for regular season success. By the way, those 5 years that they've been together, 3 first round exits, 2 appearances in the second round. And they've been out in the first round 4 of the last 5 years, or 3 of the last 4 years. They've averaged about 51 wins. If you prorate the shortened seasons, they've averaged about 51 wins in an 82 game season. So that even that stat suggests this is a good, but not great team. Great teams win in the high 50s to the 60s. They're consistently just above 50. So they're good. They're fine. They're solid. Here's where the problem is. So Rudy Gobert is an instant top five to top seven defense, right? You put Rudy Gobert on any team in the NBA and build a defensive scheme around him, you're going to be an elite defensive team. Maybe even the best defensive team. Donovan Mitchell is in the mold of the modern do-it-all guard, high usage guard, can do a lot with the ball in his hands, scoring and playmaking, shooting, slashing, whatever, although his three-point shot still needs some work. But that's not the typical 1-2 punch that gets you to title contention. You either have to have your main offensive star has to be a total freak, literally in Giannis's case. You either need a freak like Giannis or Kevin Durant or LeBron James, or an all-time great shooter in Steph Curry's case. You need somebody who's elite offensively. Donovan Mitchell's very, 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 very good offensively. He's not at that level. And you need an assemblage of other stars or guys who are near that all-star level who can score. Rudy Gobert is your second star, and he is not a nothing offensively, but he's not a scorer. He's not something you rely on in at that end at all. So you have two guys who each on their own put you at a certain level, but I think it just has a ceiling on it. And at some point you got to try something different. Also, by the way, they got a ton of money wrapped up in Rudy Gobert. I think he's making like $38 million next season. And they've got that problem too, just payroll-wise. Gobert, Mitchell, and Mike Conley together make $91 million. Throw in Bojan Bogdanovic, that's $110 million for four players. They have no flexibility whatsoever with this group, and there's no upside. Mike Conley is not getting any better at this age. Bojan Bogdanovic, not getting any better. Rudy Gobert is not going to suddenly turn into Shaq in the post. Donovan Mitchell is the one guy who can evolve still, but this has maxed out. If you are fine with just having a team that wins about 48 to 52 games and loses in the first or second round, you can continue on this path. But I don't see a path forward to make a deeper playoff run if you leave this construction as is.
All right, let me answer my own question then, because I do believe that Mitchell and Gobert can be the foundation of a championship team. And Howard, allow me to introduce myself here. I am the lead attorney of the Rudy Gobert basketball defense team, because the slander being directed at Rudy Gobert over the last couple of weeks was mind-boggling. The Mavericks, they carved the Jazz up. But if you watched that series and you say that's Rudy Gobert's fault, I don't know what series you were watching. I don't know what possessions you were watching. That Utah defense on the perimeter was abhorrent. It was leaky beyond leaky. Guards just drove by Donovan Mitchell, Bojan Bogdanovic, Mike Conley, whoever was out there on the floor, the Mavericks guards, they just went right on by. So Rudy Gobert was asked time and time again to play weak side defense. And what the Mavericks did was when they didn't get in the paint and score, they were kicking the ball out to Maxi Kleber and others who were knocking down threes. So people have said, oh, Rudy Gobert can't defend the three-point line. Well, no, you can't defend the three-point line when all you're doing all game long is playing help defense. The priority for Utah this offseason is to get better on the perimeter defensively. That might mean moving off Mike Conley to find a more defensive-minded point guard. That might mean finding someone on the perimeter that's not named Royce O'Neal who can get you stops on a regular basis. I think Rudy is just the low-hanging fruit in these arguments. It's Rudy Gobert's fault. He's bad in certain matchups. You can't play him in the postseason. Well, maybe try adding high-level perimeter defenders who are not getting beat every single time down the floor, and maybe you'll get a better version of Rudy Gobert.
I mean, look, there's no question the Jazz have lacked solid perimeter defenders, guards and wings. Like upgrading across the board there would be nice. I don't know how you get there, Chris, because they're capped out, and I don't know that there's much of a market to acquire an aging Mike Conley. There might be some market for Bogdanovic, but I don't know that swapping out those guys to get perimeter defenders, if they're available, is going to fix what ails them. And yes, Rudy Gobert would be that much better off in the postseason if he didn't have to try to guard everybody everywhere all the time. But this is how they're built. This is who they are. Donovan Mitchell's not turning into Jrue Holiday tomorrow either defensively. or Marcus
Smart.
Let me
just say this, Howard. This is what I just want to add to this. Like, someone on the Mavericks staff texted me after that series when I was talking to him about this. And they just said they want Rudy to guard everybody. And that's just not possible. You can't have Rudy out there guarding everybody. You have to have somebody else giving help.
So,
and that wasn't coming from the Jazz. That Mitchell, though, great as he is offensively, this offseason, he's got to commit more to defense. His defensive metrics were just terrible this year. They were, you know, he was in one of the lowest of levels defensively. I think he has huge upside still offensively. I think he can be your closer in big games, but none of that matters if you're getting beat on a regular basis. He has, I think, the physical tools to be a pretty good defensive player. He's not 6'7", but he's 6'3", 6'4", and he's sturdy, so he's going to be able to stand in front of a lot of guys at either guard spot. He has to take some ownership here. He's the face of this franchise, and he's got to be better defensively for this team to make any kind of run in the next couple of years.
Well, he's got to be better offensively too, by the way. A couple stats from our friend Bobby Marks in his postseason, or his obit for the Jazz slash preview of their offseason. Utah, this is according to Bobby Marks, Utah finished 23rd in clutch time net efficiency during the season and lost six games when leading by 10 or more points in the fourth, tied with the Knicks for the most blown fourth quarter leads of 10 plus. And then to Donovan Mitchell, also from Bobby Marks. Mitchell shot 33% in clutch time, the third worst field goal percentage among the 37 players to attempt at least 50 shots in the final 5 minutes of the fourth or overtime, with the score within 5 points. That's according to ESPN Stats and Info. Mitchell only made 6 of the 32 attempts from 3 and shot 25% on field goal attempts from at least 10 feet. So Donovan Mitchell, as great of a scorer and offensive player as he is, and a guy you can build a playoff team around, not great in the clutch, not a great 3-point. I think he's like a 35% 3-point shooter. That's fine. It's not good. It's not great. He averages about 5 assists a game. So as a creator, he's good, not great. There's been a lot of talk about, should he just be the full-time point guard? I don't know if that's the best way forward. I mean, listen, having him and Conley together certainly makes you undersized and compromises your defense. That's an issue for them. But making Donovan Mitchell the full-time point guard to bring in a bigger, maybe defensive-minded shooting guard next to him, okay, fine. I don't know who that is. And two, are we sure that Donovan Mitchell should have that much of the responsibility in his hands as a playmaker, not just scorer? So, look, none of this, Chris, from my end of this, is about like assessing blame. Like, no one's getting shipped out if I'm the GM based on blame. It's more just a recognition that as constructed, they've hit a ceiling. And we've seen it time and again. We've seen it enough times to know it's not working. I don't care which of them they decide to trade. I just think at this point, you have to acknowledge this is as far as it can go and pick a different direction. You know, otherwise, it's the whole definition of insanity thing.
Yeah, look, I agree with that. I wouldn't mind seeing Mitchell tried out as a point guard, though, and just bring another defensive-minded body in, as you said, at the two-guard spot, a defensive-minded wing, bring some shooters on that team. I think they still have an upside with Donovan Mitchell and Rudy Gobert as the foundation of that team. Now, I'm less sure about who's going to coach this team next year, because everything I was hearing out of Utah was something along the lines of the relationship between Quinn Snyder and Donovan Mitchell may have run its course. That it wasn't, that the chemistry just wasn't there between player and coach anymore. And look, sometimes you do need a new voice on the sideline. We've seen that happen. Hell, we just saw that happen in Boston, where, you know, Brad Stevens, who is an excellent coach, he left the bench, went upstairs, and Ime Udoka has made a significant impact with largely the same players that Brad Stevens had over in recent years. So I think a new voice can be valuable. And Quinn, if he became a coaching free agent, would be a commodity, whether it's the Lakers or somewhere else, teams would go after him. I do think, and this isn't based on any reporting at this point, just kind of what I hear out of Utah, that I do think there's a pretty good possibility you see a change with the head coach before next season. Beyond that, we'll see. I mean, Danny Ainge, who is running the show, I don't know what his title is out there. CEO? I don't know what they're labeling him. It's his show. You know, Danny Ainge is in charge and will have the final say on basketball-led decisions in Utah. He's not afraid to make bold moves. We know that from his time in Boston. And we'll see if he puts these two guys together. But I would like to see more defense around that group. and people to lay off Rudy Gobert. They were the number one defensive team in the league in the games that he played. They were 21st in defense in games that he didn't. Like, how many other players in the league can you say that about?
No.
It's wild.
Listen, Listen, Rudy Gobert with a team that has multiple offensive weapons would be fine. Rudy Gobert is the second star and being paid your highest salary on a team that has Donovan Mitchell and then a big drop off. Like, that's the problem. Like, this is not it's not necessarily a Rudy Gobert issue. He would, you know, and then the fun of this offseason in part is going to be, with apologies to Jazz fans, is going to be trying to figure out where Gobert goes and for what. Like, I am very curious to see what his ultimate market value is if they decide to trade him. What can they get for him? Because the Jazz could set themselves up pretty well. I think you should get a boatload back for Rudy Gobert. Offensive limitations notwithstanding, you put him with, you know, I don't think this is a Warriors situation, but you put him on the Warriors, no one's worried about his offensive production or even defensive limitations because you'd have decent perimeter defenders. You put him on the Celtics, for instance, obviously, again, not going to happen. They've got Robert Williams, but you can see the model of, like, right, Robert Williams is better on the perimeter than Rudy Gobert, but Robert Williams doesn't have to guard everybody all the time because they have Marcus Smart and Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum guarding people in a way that the Jazz do not have. But I'm just saying, like, there's models out there of teams where you have a defensive-minded center, a rim protector who doesn't necessarily do a ton else and doesn't have to. So get Rudy Gobert on the right team, and suddenly he won't be getting knocked for the things that he's been knocked for. We'll only be praising how great he makes your defense. But with this Jazz team, with built-in limitations to it, it does make him look like the liability.
Yeah, well, I love Robert Williams. He's only getting better. But you put Rudy Gobert on the Celtics in his place, they might give up like 0 points a game. Like Smart, Brown, that collection of guys on the perimeter, Rudy Gobert backstopping it. I mean, that's... I know people, the counter would be like Robert Williams can switch and he plays that defense. I actually think Rudy's pretty good on some of the switches. Like, I don't think he's like this, you know, he's not like a lumbering liability when he winds up switched on a guard. So yeah. I think he's okay.
I haven't done any like trade machine games with this, but like Rudy Gobert on the Raptors would be really interesting. Like, there's a team that needs
that's a place I've heard too. That's a place I've heard too mentioned as far as Gobert goes.
Rudy Gobert on the Nets. I don't know how the heck they'd get him. I don't think they can. But you know, there are
Kyrie
some teams.
For Rudy. Kyrie for Rudy, right there.
Kyrie in Utah. Oh my God.
I just think you hate the French, Howard. That's what I think. You're right by French.
I love France. Love the French. Yeah. I miss Paris. Right, I've been there a long time.
Let's finish with a couple of quick things. Draymond Green ejected early in game one of the series against Memphis. Did we think that ejection was warranted? Kane Fitzgerald, pretty quick on the trigger there for that ejection on Draymond. Was that Draymond suggested on his podcast? And by the way, did Draymond record that podcast like in the locker room after, like, talk about modern media? Draymond Green does a podcast over with the volume, like Colin Cowherd. Like, you think he did it like in the locker room?
That thing was out like before the team bus left the arena.
He might have gone back to the hotel by himself and just recorded his podcast.
That was impressive work.
Do you agree with him though, Howard? Do you agree was more reputational than...
No, I don't agree with the ejection. I don't agree with the ejection. Yeah. And I do think that Draymond does suffer from reputation in these cases, but that's kind of earned also, right? Like, I don't have a ton of sympathy for Draymond or anybody else who's put them in this position over the course of history in the NBA. If you earn a reputation as being a guy who does a lot of extra stuff, you're going to be judged that way. And was it fair in the context of just this one incident yesterday? No, I don't think he should have been ejected. Did he maybe get less benefit of the doubt because he's Draymond Green and has a history? Yeah, that happens. Like, the NBA doesn't even deny it. I'm not saying with Draymond specifically. The NBA will tell you, yes, of course they take into account what a guy has done in the past. But nothing that Draymond Green did on that play to me warranted a flagrant two and an ejection. I thought that was an overreaction, to say the least. I'm stunned as we record this on Monday afternoon. We've already heard reports that, or I guess the NBA has already told a few people who have asked, they're not downgrading it to a flagrant one. I thought they should have. And it's certainly putting Draymond Green and the Warriors in a tough spot because there's several rounds to go here if they're going to make the finals. And if he gets another flagrant two, it's an automatic one-game suspension. We're back to 2016.
Yeah, that's I agree with you. That felt more like reputation. If Klay Thompson does that, I don't think he gets a flagrant two.
No.
I don't like it. I feel like if you're in the playoffs, and look, whether NBA referees or the league wants to admit it or not, games are officiated differently in the playoffs. You allow a higher level of physicality in the postseason. It's true. You know, you hear players talking about it, like what you can get away with. I was sitting listening to Grant Williams the other day talk about how he can get away with more in the postseason. I'm not saying you let things get out of control, but a play like that, if you're going to lean one way, lean towards letting the player play, you know, and let the NBA deal with it after the fact. Let them elevate it to a flagrant two and hit him with a fine and the possible suspension later in the playoffs. Don't do it in the middle of a game. You know, the Warriors won, which, you know, kept the conversation down a little bit, tempered a little bit. But if they hadn't and wound up losing the series, you don't want that on the shoulders of the NBA.
You know how this wasn't an egregious flagrant two type of foul? Because the Grizzlies didn't react that way. The Grizzlies didn't start pushing and shoving and screaming and saying, look what you did to our guy. Like, there was none of that usual in the moment reaction that indicates that something dirty had happened or something egregious had happened or something that we need to get payback for had happened. None of that was happening. And you saw Draymond try to catch him as he accidentally snagged his jersey. And I thought that looked accidental. That looked unintentional. The whole thing about follow through and he hit him in the face. Yes, sometimes you're going for the ball and you accidentally strike a guy in the head. It happens every single game. And normally on a review, that becomes a flagrant one, because if it wasn't egregious and it was seemingly incidental, you do the flagrant one because the NBA does everything as a flagrant one if there's any contact to the head now. That's fine. But taking that and then basically making it, they basically called two flagrant ones and added it up to a flagrant two. One for the initial contact to the head, which most of us didn't even notice in real time. And then two for the jersey slash takedown, a takedown in which he was trying to soften the blow and trying not to have him fall hard. So, like, nothing about it made sense to me. The NBA is in a really weird place with regard to flagrants. Joe Dumars just got named the new executive vice president and head of basketball operations today. That's the role formerly filled by Kiki Vandeweghe. In past years, Stu Jackson, Rod Thorne. This is basically the dean of discipline and just also the overlord of all the rules, applications, flagrants, and technicals, and upgrades and downgrades and all that stuff. Maybe Joe Dumars, who came from the Bad Boys Pistons, will get to Olympic Tower and give some folks a talking to about where this has gone and that maybe they need to reassess and back off just a tad.
Joe Dumars has to be looking at some of these flagrant fouls and going, what? Like, do you know what Bill Laimbeer did to players during my day? Do you know what Chuck Daly told us to do to players during my day? I mean,
and
come on.
By the way, neither of us are suggesting we should go back to the Bad Boys days of the 90s.
No.
Nobody wants to go back to all of that stuff and have the game slow to a crawl and guys beating the crap out of each other and getting clocked in the lane and clotheslined. Nobody's saying that, but they have overcorrected. We are too far the other direction if that's a flagrant two yesterday.
Yeah, I agree. Last thing, Doc Rivers, his 76ers escaped the first round and escaped, you know, potentially being the first team to blow a 3-0 series lead. Doc, a little bit of sensitivity, Howard, to some of the critiques of him and, you know, the inevitable stories that cropped up when the Sixers lost two games to Toronto and were headed back to Canada. What did you make of Doc's frustration? Then his explanations. He went into detail describing kind of what happened in each of the series that his team blew big leads.
Look, you and I are in the media game. This is what we do. We love coaches who love to talk and who love to tell stories and who don't mind engaging on any number of issues. And Doc, you know, if we ever bring back the all interview team, something that we had 20 years ago, Doc would be a perennial candidate for coach of the all interview team. He's great that way. And yet there are times where you're thinking, Doc, I'm glad you're engaging us on all this. But man, so defensive on the 3-1 thing. And I get that. Like, I do think he has been unfairly painted based on this history of blown 3-1 leads. Like, there's context to every single one of those. And some maybe are more on him than others. But a blown 3-1 series lead is never just about, oh, the coach made a bunch of wrong decisions and therefore his team collapsed. Like, give me a break. Like, the reductiveness in those arguments are annoying even to me, and it's not my reputation. So I'm not here to defend Doc. I do think he has reason to want to deconstruct that when he hears that being brought up a lot. I do think also, though, he was too defensive on that. And then, of course, Embiid gets, smashed in the face and has the fractured orbital and the concussion that's now leaving him out for the start of this series. And Doc had left him in the game with a 29-point lead, and now he's defensive about that. I love that Doc Rivers will always talk to us and engage and be spirited about it and be passionate about it and be thoughtful about it. I think he's doing himself no favors when he's this defensive. I think occasionally a coach needs to just like say, you know what? Yeah, looking back, I should have had Joel on the bench at that point. Like, that's fine. And you can say too, if you want to, you can never predict what's going to happen. And especially in today's game, leads vanish quickly. There's a billion times you could do this a billion times and have the other 999,999,000, whatever, not result in one of your most important players getting hurt. But when it does happen, you should take a step back and say, you know what? I get why people are upset. Even if you don't want to say it was the wrong choice, you could still at least acknowledge why it's a concern and a criticism without being so defensive. So it was like it's a very defensive week for Doc Rivers. His defense was far better than the Brooklyn Nets. Let's just say that.
Hey, with Doc, I think Doc's a very good coach. I think he gets a lot of criticism for his rotation, substitutions, all those things. But I have always said, Howard, that coaching superstars is not easy. Like, it's just not. And Doc is one of a handful of coaches in this league that has proven at the highest level that he can coach superstars. He had a energizing, electric, combustible at times team in Boston when it came to having KG and Paul Pierce and Rajon Rondo all together as a group. And Doc, you know, he was a huge factor in that team winning a championship in 08. I'd also tell him, somebody asked, like, why Joel was in the game. And maybe he shouldn't have been. You know, maybe he shouldn't have been. That's sure. But, like, have you seen the on-off numbers when he's not the last couple of games? Like, you know, no lead is safe. All right, guys. You can't say this, but, like, our team can't win unless he's on the floor until the final buzzer. So, you know, maybe they if given truth serum, he would say something like that. So, we'll see.
Yeah.
Howard, good stuff, man. Always appreciate it. We'll do it again next week.
Always a pleasure, my friend.
At Kroger Pharmacy, Care is making it easy to get vaccinated. Care is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. Care is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.